Hello there, I'm Laura Sullivan, and you're listening to the podcast of Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. This is where we get to bring you our favorite stories from the Saturday and Sunday shows. First up, America's next big step in science, mapping the human brain.
Not only does it have 86 billion neurons, not only does it have 100 trillion connections, but those connections are changing all the time.
Is it worth it? Plus, half a century later, we are still talking about Alcatraz.
We had the best food of any prison in the United States.
I'll testify to that.
Then, a rare magic trick, conjuring up a female magician.
He said, you know what, if you could take your clothes off, well, I could get you all the work you could imagine.
In books, athletes today breaking with 20 years of boring post-game banter to take on social change.
Look, it's not like athletes have our own CNN channel that we watch. We're part of this world, too.
And Scottish actor James McAvoy on deciding not to become a priest and instead becoming an actor playing Macbeth.
I have been injured playing this guy so much more than any action movie I've been on.
And finally, the music. Sheik Amin's vocal genius.
I just wanna be closer. All right. Just a little closer. That's fine. Why can't I feel? Oh, 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 oh. When all the signs that stand in our way. Go side. Just lead to the highway. Go side. Saying it's not time. No time. For you and me.
During the State of the Union, President Obama said the nation is about to embark on an ambitious project to examine the human brain and create a roadmap to the trillions of connections that make it work.
Every dollar we invested to map the human genome returned $140 to our economy. Every dollar. Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's.
Details of the project have been slowly leaking out. $3 billion, 10 years, hundreds of scientists. The National Institutes of Health is calling it the Brain Activity Map. President Obama isn't the first to tout the benefits of a huge government science project. But can these projects really deliver? And what is mapping the human brain really going to get us? That's our cover story today. Big science, big project, big promises. Will mapping the brain be worth it? Before diving into the human brain, let's look back a decade to the completion of another $3 billion government project, the Human Genome Project, which mapped our DNA. Here's President Clinton in 2000.
It will revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases.
That is still a bit of a stretch, even 10 years later. But for one man in particular, it turned out not to be a stretch at all.
Hi, my name's Lucas Wortman. I'm a physician scientist, oncologist.
When President Clinton was giving his Human Genome Project speech, Wortman had just entered medical school, and he started to feel like something was wrong.
Began having pretty severe bone pain and high fevers, and finally drug myself into the doctor. And so the next day I had a bone marrow biopsy, which showed kind of the unthinkable that I had actually leukemia.
Right away, Lucas Wortman began chemotherapy treatment. He responded well, and he went into remission. He finished medical school, and then the cancer came back.
By this time, I was an oncologist myself, so I kind of knew what was going on.
He took on intensive rounds of chemo and a stem cell replacement surgery. He was grateful when it worked, and he was ready to build a life. He focused on his research in the cancer lab, and he was thinking about the future. And then one night, the fevers came back. And the exhaustion, and he knew. He just couldn't face it.
So this time I did ignore it for a little while and kept all of my vacation plans and went to Spain and went to my friends' weddings. And the last thing I wanted to think about was the possibility of this coming back again, because I knew now that the odds of me surviving yet another relapse of this leukemia were just really, really poor.
He joined a clinical trial. It failed. There was nothing left. It was a death sentence. Except Wortman and his fellow researchers at the lab started thinking. The Human Genome Project had figured out how to map healthy genes. They decided that they could use that same technology to map Wortman's healthy genes and then compare them to Wortman's cancer genes. When they did compare them, they found a protein that the cancer relied on to survive. Wortmann scoured the database of every known drug on the market and found a drug made for something else entirely that just so happens to kill the very protein that his cancer needed to live.
So I think that I started taking the drug on a Friday, and at this time my blood counts were low, the leukemia wasn't very well controlled. But by Monday, when I had my blood tested again, my blood counts had perked up. The only word, and I don't necessarily mean this in like a religious context per se, but I mean this was almost like a miraculous response to this drug.
Now everyone else in the country with a form of leukemia that he had and who aren't responding to chemo use that same drug.
I probably wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for the Human Genome Project in reality, because I definitely benefited from the finances and the effort that the government put into focused research question. And it had very tangible benefits in my particular case.
30 years ago, no one would have believed that what Wortmann and his colleagues did with the technology from the Human Genome Project would have been possible. Today, a lot of scientists are hoping the same thing will be true of brain mapping, that perhaps it will unlock the secrets of Alzheimer's and schizophrenia and Parkinson's.
With the brain, we're kind of at the same stage as we were in the early 80s with the genome.
Carl Zimmer is a science writer, and Zimmer says there's no way to know what mapping the brain can do. But if it happens, it's going to be pricey and it's going to be complicated.
People have been studying the brain for centuries and they've been mapping it. But the brain is just so complex that we barely understand it now. I mean, we have maybe 85 billion neurons in our heads, but we can only listen to maybe 1,000, 1,200 of them at once. That's it. So we are really only getting this tiny, tiny little picture of what the brain is doing.
What does it mean to map the brain? Is this like a Google map of the brain? Is this something visual that you can see on your computer?
There are different ways to map the brain. Scientists, for example, right now map the brain with MRI, but the resolution only goes down to about a cubic millimeter, about the size of a poppy seed. And, you know, you can have hundreds of thousands or millions of neurons packed in there with all sorts of intricate wiring.
Inside that one poppy seed.
Just inside that one, yeah. So if you really want to know the geography of the brain, you have to be able to zoom in down on that level. And so there are people who are trying to go down to that level. The problem is that it's slow. Even to just get 1 millimeter of the brain is a huge effort. So that could take a long time.
And it's happening already. It's happening outside of the brain mapping project.
Oh, yeah. This is happening in labs all over the world. The thing is that people aren't working together and saying, okay, who's going to handle this? Who's going to handle that? Who takes care of that? But in the case of the Human Genome Project, what happened was that the government said, okay, we're going to coordinate all of this, and we're going to together get this genome sequenced. That's what the brain activity map people would like to do, is to coordinate all this effort towards a common goal.
What can we look for in the coming weeks and months or coming years when it comes to this project?
The first step is going to actually see the details of the plan. No one's seen the details of the plan yet. And then we're going to see neuroscientists getting on board or complaining about it and saying it's a bad idea. We're going to see that debate unfold in the next, I'd say, few months. Now, if the brain activity map does go forward, then, you know, in the first few years, it's going to be pretty underwhelming for people who suddenly think that they're going to get cures for Alzheimer's, because a lot of the focus is going to be on looking at the brain of, say, a fruit fly. And people might get very angry and say, the government's wasting money on fruit flies. But the fact is that you have to walk before you can run. And in order to develop the tools to map a human brain, you got to start with much, much, much smaller brains made of the same basic kind of neurons, like the brains of flies. So look for big headlines about fruit flies in the next couple of years.
Science writer Carl Zimmer. Getting the science community on board with a brain mapping project could be tough. Michael Eisen of UC Berkeley is one biologist who has already started campaigning against it.
The idea that science should be organized and funded in massive, centrally run projects that are organized by committees and bureaucrats in Washington rather than by individual scientists pursuing their own creative ideas in their own labs. As appealing as it may be to think about, you know, harnessing massive amounts of energy, all getting everybody together in one place and getting us all on board with the same program, that just doesn't work.
Well, you know what I'm going to say here, right? I mean, the atomic bomb, putting a man on the moon, and the Human Genome Project.
There are times when we know exactly what we have to do. Build an atomic bomb, although I'm not sure that's everybody's idea of a good science project, or send an astronaut to the moon, or sequence the human genome, where it does take an effort of a lot of scientists coming together and working in a coordinated manner to solve it. But this is not one of those problems. If you listen to neuroscience talk about this today, they don't really even know what it means to understand the brain. This is not a moonshot, right? This is a perfect example of where biology is not rocket science. And there's plenty of evidence that when what's required is creativity and innovation and new insights into systems, that the worst thing you can do is to put, you know, 500 scientists in a room and have them all pursue a consensus plan to get there.
Carl Zimmer says there's also another problem. How do you know when you're done mapping the brain?
The problem is that while the genome was finite, the brain is really infinite because not only does it have 86 billion neurons, not only does it have 100 trillion connections, but those connections are changing all the time. It's very dynamic. And that's actually what matters to us, is that dynamic nature of the brain. Our brains are changing moment to moment right now. So when do you know when you finished mapping the brain? You might never finish it.
But for Lucas Wortman, whose life was saved by gene mapping, it's far simpler. He says we have to take the leap and spend the money, cross our fingers, and hope.
I do understand that there's, you know, resistance to it. But at the same time, while it's not a sure bet, it's a bet that if it does pay off could really reap tremendous benefits for humanity. And so I think as a society, it would be great if we were willing to commit to supporting projects like that.
The details of the president's brain mapping project are expected to be released in the coming weeks in his budget proposal. Quick trivia question. Name a global superpower technology company that is the world's biggest seller of smartphones, headed by a charismatic CEO surrounded by a cult of personality. I'm guessing most of you just said Apple, right? You would be wrong. The answer is Samsung. Bloomberg journalist Sam Grobar gained access to the South Korean company's facilities and wrote about his experiences for Bloomberg Business Week. Sam Grobar is here with us to share some of the most surprising things he found during his trip to Seoul. Welcome, and thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Laura.
Samsung is really more than smartphones, which might surprise some Americans. How does it intersect with the daily lives of, say, someone living in South Korea?
Well, it intersects in almost every way. If you live in Seoul, you may have been born at the Samsung Medical Center, and you may be brought home to your apartment building, which was built by Samsung's construction division. And perhaps you're put into a crib which came over from China on a cargo ship that Samsung built. And you're watching a Samsung TV when you're a little older, and you're seeing advertisements on that TV that were created by Samsung's advertising agency, perhaps for Samsung Life, one of the world's largest life insurance companies. And you're wearing some clothes from Beanpole, which is also a division of Samsung.
Wow.
And you go to your Samsung refrigerator, and so on and so forth.
Wow. In terms of South Korea, this must be an enormous chunk of their GDP.
Approximately 20%.
Wow, from one company.
From one company.
So this is a company that's really driven by its CEO, a man named Lee Kun-hee. Tell me about him.
So Chairman Lee is the son of the founder of Samsung, and it's under his administration that it has really grown to these stratospheric heights.
So take us back to 1993. Chairman Lee Kun-hee walks into a California store that sells televisions, and he sees a Samsung television on the bottom shelf in the far back.
Yes. According to sort of corporate lore, that was the moment when he decided that he needed to make it into a world player. And he decides he needs to summon his top executives, come to Frankfurt. And they proceed to sit in a room where he lays out his strategy for the company. And this lasts 3 days. When you're visiting the Human Resources Development Center in Yongin, which is outside of Seoul, you come upon this recreation of that room, and all of the items within it have been taken from the hotel in Germany and reassembled in Korea.
Is that a bit unusual?
Oh, I would say it's very unusual.
What's the work culture like?
Constant efficiency, constant improvement. There's none of the sort of highly creative, you know, hey, do what you want to do, man, and I'm sure it's going to work out. It's, no, no, you're going to go build those smartphones right now, and you're going to make sure that they are perfect.
Whatever it is that they're doing seems to be working because, as you write, the Galaxy smartphone that they produce is now outselling the iPhone.
Yes, that is happening globally. So Samsung now outsells Apple in smartphones. It outsells Nokia in all mobile phones. And they show no sign of stopping.
How did they break into the smartphone market?
So what they do is they start by building a component for an overall device. Obviously, there's been a lot of patent law disputes between Samsung and Apple, and many other companies are involved in that. But somebody does need to supply these components. So Samsung actually builds the microprocessor that is in the iPhone. And in doing so, they're able to gain an understanding of how that market works, and then they start building devices themselves. So if Apple comes along in 2009 and says, we need you to build a quad-core microprocessor, well, someone in Samsung is going to ask, why?
Why do they need a quad-core
Why do they
processor?
Need that? What are they doing with that? Oh, and since they can see that far down the road, perhaps they would like to start building something like that. They have an advantage that almost no other company has. At some level, there is a strategic advantage to knowing what people want.
Sam Grobart is a writer for Bloomberg, and his article, How Samsung Became the World's Number One Smartphone Maker, is in the latest edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alcatraz, perhaps the country's most famous prison. It shut its gates 50 years ago this month. Even after all these years, we're still fascinated by the rock and with those who lived there. We went in search of a former inmate and a former guard and found one of each, Robert Scheiblein and Jim Albright. Robert, let's start with you. Take us back there. What was it like?
Well, the reputation of Alcatraz went far and wide, even us convicts. And I had a bit of interpretation when I got on the bus and seen that thing sitting out in the island, out in the bay, shrouded by fog. And I thought, oh boy, here I go again into the world's unknown.
Jim Albright, you were one of the last guards off the island when it closed 50 years ago. What do you remember about Alcatraz? What was that job like?
I remember I was only 24 when I started there. And I had no previous experience. And so it was kind of fearful, and you'd be apprehensive, and it was exciting and everything, especially when you walked through the door for the first time and they slammed the door behind you because you didn't know what to expect. And I remember Robert was a young, tough kid with dark hair, and he was very personable.
Robert, do you remember Jim Albright?
Yes, I do. I ain't going to say anything bad, but nothing good. He's a guard. That's all I can say. I'd have a complete detest for all prison guards, especially if he's still alive.
I would imagine it's difficult to be the inmate because you are there because you've committed a crime.
Well, I realize that. I realize that it was my fault I was there.
What crime did you commit?
A bank robbery.
But I think there's a little bit of a story there, isn't there? It's 1958. I think you were also in the Navy at the time.
Oh, you want the Navy story.
In the Navy at the time that you were a bank robber.
Well, when I was in the Navy, everybody going ashore to do their drinking and honky-tonking. Well, me and my buddy would go and we'd rob a bank. And we'd scamper back to the ship, our aircraft carrier, and the next day when we pull out to go to a different port, we'd get all around the roadblocks by going out to sea.
Jim Albright, how would you describe the relationship between the guards and the inmates while you were there?
I'd say for the circumstances, it was pretty good. Because I wasn't there to harass them. I was just there to make sure they didn't escape.
Well, while you were a guard on Alcatraz, there was the famous 1962 escape from Alcatraz, where three inmates made a boat out of raincoats and attempted to sail off into the night. They were never seen or heard from again. Tell us about that night and what had happened.
Well, that was Frank Morse and John Clarence Anglin. The alarm woke me up, and I'd been over town playing ball the night before, and I twisted my knee, and I had crutches, and so I was out crutching up the hill, and I wanted to see what was going on. And I stepped up to the cell, and the dummy head was so real that at high noon, I thought I had the wrong cell and moved over to the next cell.
The dummy head is, of course, the heads that the inmates made out of wax and soap and a homemade paint that they put inside the beds so that the guards and officers would think that they were sleeping that night when they were actually crawling up the drain pipes and out onto the roof and out into the water. What went through your head when you realized that these three inmates had escaped?
Well, of course, our first job was to search and try and find them.
Robert, do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Robert, what was the mood like the morning that the three men escaped?
Oh, exhilaration. Everybody was very happy that they made it out of the cell block and out of the prison. And I knew the Anglin brothers really, really well, John and Clarence. They're from Florida here. And Clarence Anglin worked in the barbershop, which is right across from my cell. And one of the guys that was against the rules, apparently, I didn't know this at the time, but he brought in a newspaper occasionally when he worked out in the docks. And I was able to get access to the paper out of the garbage can and get the tie tables off to Clarence.
And Robert, are you saying that you helped Clarence Anglin escape from Alcatraz?
Yeah. I think out of the 100, out of 250-some people there, there must have been at least 150 who knew about the escape for 6 months before it happened.
Wow. Jim, does that surprise you?
No, because they all wanted to feel like they was wanted, you know, and helped them escape.
They were never seen or heard from again. Most people believe that they drowned in the bay or in the Pacific Ocean. Do you think they made it, Jim?
Oh, no, no. If they did make it, why didn't they 5 years after they're not caught go turn themselves in? They'd be so famous to be on Jay Leno show and Oprah show and Today shows and have books and movies. And
yeah.
And all the inmates felt like they made it and all the officers felt like they didn't make it.
Exactly. And I'm agreeing with Jim. For the first time in my life, I'm agreeing with a guard.
So we're finding some common ground between officer and inmate.
Made me too, Willie.
50 years will do that, I imagine. Well, let's talk about the food of Alcatraz.
The best in the prison system, no matter where you go.
Yeah, it was great. We had the best food of any prison in the United States.
I'll testify to that.
Jim, what did you do after you left Alcatraz?
22 years at 4 more prisons.
Wow. How does Alcatraz stand up to those other prisons?
I would go back there right now if everything was equal.
Robert, I'm going to imagine that you would not like to go back to Alcatraz.
No, but if I had a new time, I'd rather do it there.
And tell me about your last day, Robert, on Alcatraz.
You never forewarned about this stuff. They just said, pack up your stuff, you're going.
And Jim, what was your last day on Alcatraz like?
I escorted the last inmate, Frank Weatherman, off the island, and took him to town, put him on the airplane, and flew him to Leavenworth, Atlanta. But as we're going out, and I know when I come back from this trip, I don't have a job. I don't have a home anymore.
Oh, what did you feel?
Well, of course, it was sad. I didn't want the island to close. I didn't want to leave. I liked it there.
Yeah. How many times have you been back?
Oh, probably a dozen.
Robert, have you ever been back?
Yeah, I went back in 2005.
What was that like?
I was amazed. They treated me like a rock star.
Robert, do you think after this conversation today that you don't hate the guards so much?
No change in my head whatsoever. I'm frozen. I'm an old elephant when it comes to that.
Jim, I hope that doesn't hurt your feelings too much.
No.
Oh, it's nothing personal. He's a guard.
But I enjoyed talking to him.
Well, Robert Scheiblein and Jim Albright, a former inmate and a former guard on the famous island of Alcatraz, thank you both so much for talking to us today and each other.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
To see some photos of that last day on Alcatraz, visit our website, npr.org. And in case you were wondering, Robert Scheiblein opened a scuba diving shop after his release and ran it for 40 years. He has recently retired to Florida.
That's me and my grandmother. She was a showgirl. I used to come visit her in Vegas, and that's when I first saw your show at the Golden Nugget. It was so good.
I knew right then and there that I wanted to do magic.
Really?
Yes. Do you know what time it is?
It... Very good. Give it back, please.
I already did.
That was a clip from the movie The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, and it shows us something that's very rare in the magic world. A female magician working. And by working, I mean not as the leggy assistant or getting sawed in half, but a female magician creating the magic. It's not something you see very often. So we set out to find a magician of our own and found ourselves a female Houdini with a magical story.
This is Dorothy Dietrich. I am a female magician and an escape artist. Now, I grew up with six brothers and two sisters, and I was a very girly girl. I was not tough at all. So they'd only let me play if I was going to play cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers, and I'd be the one that gets tied to the tree or tied to the chair. And I would always escape, and I never thought that was unusual at all. So one day my aunt was visiting, and she said, "Who do you think you are, Houdini?" And I said, "Who's that?" And so I got the book and read it, and I couldn't put it down. I saw a magician at the grade school. The music went on, and the magician started performing. And I was like, wow. I was not only impressed by the magic, but I was impressed that everybody in the room was totally into the show. Absolutely and totally into the show. So I was going around doing shows at birthday parties and family parties. And that was really what gave me the idea that I could actually do this, that I could go and amaze a crowd, and they were all happy at the end, and I got good tips at the end. So I said, okay, this is probably a great thing for me. The agents in New York, the bookings they had for females, you know, there's these guys in the room, and they're at the desk, the big wooden desk, and they're smoking a cigar at you. The one agent actually said to me, he says, "You know, a girl doing magic? I don't know. I don't see it. I don't know if an audience could even, you know, I mean," he said, "You know what? If you could take your clothes off, I could get you booking nonstop. Boy, I could get you all the work you could imagine. You're gorgeous. Yeah, let's do it that way." And I said, "Okay, no. In fact, I absolutely don't want to be anything like that. So if you are interested, if you could believe in me and give me some work, you will love what you're going to see." And I had to do that talk with every one of them. Wherever there was a magic meeting announced, you know, I'd go and show up and ask someone to teach me, or who does lessons and all that. And they'd all go like, here, honey, pick a card. And I'd pick a card and remember it, and there's the trick, it's over. And I'd say, "Oh, could you teach me that? That's a terrific trick. Could you teach me that?" They'd say, sure, here, pick another card and show me another trick, you know. And they never wanted to teach me. They really honestly didn't think there was any reason to teach a female any magic secrets. They just couldn't even see it. And even today, when I show up with my props, if they don't know who I am, if it's just somebody in the committee or whatever, they'll say, "Oh, are you going to be sawed in half today?" And I go, "Oh, no, I might saw someone in half, though."
That was Dorothy Dietrich, founder of the Houdini Museum in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Dorothy is one of the first female escape artists and has performed death-defying stunts all around the world. This story was inspired by an Atlantic article called "Why Are There So Few Female Magicians?" A new book outlines the uneasy confluence of sports and politics. It's easy to remember famous athletes during the Civil Rights Movement or the Vietnam War, making their views known. Sometimes those views isolated them from fans, but sometimes what athletes said led to real change. But for the past 10 or 20 years now, it's difficult to think of many athletes talking about anything other than gym shoes and soda. Some say those endorsement deals make sports stars gun-shy about speaking their minds. Dave Zirin's book is called Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And Zirin thinks he's seen evidence recently that taking a public stand is coming back into vogue for sports figures.
Well, there's been a big change in the world of sports since roughly 2008. And one of those changes is athletes becoming more sophisticated with tools like social media and going beyond a sports media that they largely do not trust to speak to fans directly about the issues that they care about. The other issue is that since 2008, there's been a lot of crisis both in this country and around the world. And as one athlete says, and I quote him in the book, he says, look, it's not like athletes have our own CNN channel that we watch. We're part of this world too. And when we see things, we want to respond to it.
Why 2008 now?
There were a couple of things that happened in 2008. The first was the election of Barack Obama. I mean, you had players like Kevin Garnett with political slogans written on his sneakers, LeBron James wearing Barack Obama t-shirts. I remember Carmelo Anthony said he was going to score 42 points in honor of the 42nd president. He only scored 28, which might have been his Woodrow Wilson tribute. But still, he wanted to be political. And that in and of itself was breaching a wall to do that. The other thing that happened in 2008, of course, was the economic crisis. I mean, there have been four lockouts in sports in just the last year. And all of that is linked to the fact that the leagues themselves felt like that they were going to not get the kind of public subsidies that they'd been used to in years past.
So you're saying that made the players more politically active in their own right.
Because they were locked out and because they were then forced to actually speak to the public about why they should side with them and not see these labor battles as just, as so many people say, billionaires versus millionaires.
Right. So what are the risks for athletes?
Ooh. See, that's the flip side of it. There are significant risks, not the least of which is that a typical athletic playing career is very short. In the NFL, it's 3.5 years. And in baseball and in the NBA, it's really not much longer. It's 5 years, 7 years. So you're talking about a very limited window where athletes can earn the majority of money that they're going to make over the course of their entire lives.
So you've got players that are trying to walk this fine line between making a name for themselves, getting out there in front of the public, and supporting a belief that they feel passionate about.
Right.
But at the same time, not overdoing it.
If you go too far, okay, it's trouble. Sports has become a trillion-dollar global entity by projecting athletes really who are as bland and apolitical as possible so they don't offend anybody in the audience. I mean, Michael Jordan famously said Republicans buy sneakers too when asked if he would stand up against his hometown Senator Jesse Helms in 1990. And that's been kind of like this anthemic phrase, Republicans buy sneakers too, as a way to say to athletes, don't step out of line. It becomes something that actually is very dangerous, whether for keeping their job in the league, whether for keeping sponsors. And you do run that risk of finding yourself all of a sudden out of a job.
What's an example of an athlete that went too far?
Well, the athletes who a lot of people talk about even to this day is there was a player named Craig Hodges in 1992, and there was a player named Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf in 1996. And Craig Hodges won a world championship with the Chicago Bulls and at the White House handed a letter against the Persian Gulf War directly to George H.W. Bush, found himself off the team. Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf in 1996 made the private decision that he wasn't going to come out for the national anthem before games because he disagreed just morally with the idea of paying tribute to the American flag before games. It became a huge uproar in Denver. He found himself drummed out of the league as soon as his contract was done in the prime of his career. His last year in the league, he led the NBA in points per minute. He was gone.
And this was all happening in the 90s.
In the 90s. Now, you fast forward now to today. There's a player named Rashard Mendenhall, still plays in the National Football League, lost all of his endorsement contracts when he was playing for the Pittsburgh Steelers. He just left the Steelers and signed with the Cardinals. And he put out tweets that he wasn't going to join the celebratory atmosphere when bin Laden was assassinated. And that's obviously something that the overwhelming majority of Americans would say, no, we are going to cheer. This is a moment to celebrate. And yet for Rashard Mendenhall, it was not. And he lost his endorsements. He was called out by his owner. They were just done. And he was somebody who was becoming a star at that point.
I'm talking to sports writer Dave Zirin. His new book is called Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Dave, you really went to town on the NCAA in this book and the notion of student athletes. In fact, you keep putting student athletes in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm. The main reason I did that was after speaking to a former All-American NCAA basketball player from the University of Maryland by the name of Laron Prophet. And Laron said to me, the word student athlete is so ridiculous because we're really athlete students, because the second we walk onto campus, it's made very clear to us where our priorities should lie. And as soon as he said that to me, I said, you know, I'm never using the phrase student athlete again. And then after researching it, that's not a word that came out of, say, the pen of Grantland Rice 100 years ago, the great sports writer, as a poetical phrase for somebody on campus. It was actually a legal designation put forward by the NCAA so they wouldn't have to pay workers' compensation to a crippled football player. Because a college football player actually sued the NCAA saying, I deserve some sort of compensation. My body's been destroyed by playing football. And their response was, well, no, you don't get workers' compensation because you're not a worker. You're a student athlete. So they actually concocted this designation. And they generate really billions of dollars. I mean, the NCAA tournament is an $11 billion deal all by itself. Coaches make millions, and the players don't see a thing. And it's only – this is one of those things where I really do believe that the center will not hold. Because coaches keep getting paid more and more. Players more and more are seeing the NCAA as really this amoral tool of enforcement, like something that has no real moral weight.
Do you think that this is one of these political beliefs that we're going to see some of the players start standing up for?
Definitely. And you have seen this in the past at different times. I mean, you saw 20 years ago, the great University of Michigan Fab Five team, they all came out on the court wearing black T-shirts instead of their jerseys to protest that the jerseys were the top-selling jersey in the country with their names on it, but they weren't seeing any money for it. A few years ago, as Taylor Branch reported in The Atlantic, there was a move by players to actually strike before the Final Four, unless they got some money for that. It's very difficult for college athletes to do this, though, because this is one of those things that people don't know when they say, wait a minute, these guys get a free full 4-year ride to college, and it costs a fortune. They should be happy to get that. The scholarships are only renewed on an annual basis. They don't get 4 years. They get 1 year. And when you're renewed year to year, it doesn't exactly breed an atmosphere of, hey, I'm going to speak out for my rights.
I would imagine that.
Yeah.
That's sports writer Dave Zirin from The Nation. His new book is called Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Dave, thanks so much for coming in.
My privilege. Thank you.
Elizabeth, they're going to kill me.
That's Scottish actor James McAvoy. He stars in the new heist thriller Trance, the latest film from director Danny Boyle, best known for the Oscar winner Slumdog Millionaire. In the movie, McAvoy plays Simon, an art auctioneer with a gambling problem who ends up mixed up with a gang of criminals. Although the 33-year-old has been dying to work with Boyle for years, he says he almost didn't take the part. At first glance, Simon seemed to be a victim, and McAvoy says that didn't interest him. But as he spent more time with the character, he changed his mind.
And then I got about 15 or 20 pages in, and I started to sense that something else was coming in the character. And then something else did come. And then about every 10 pages, something else came, until at the end, I was hanching at the bit, as we say in Scotland. Hanching at the bit.
Okay.
I think, do you know what? I know what it means, but I don't know the genius of it. It just means I was desperate. I think it might come from the bit that is between a horse's teeth, and hanching might just mean desperately sort of gnawing at it and chewing at it.
I think that we say chomping at the bit.
You guys say chomping, we say hanching. So I was hungry to play this part.
Remember, do not be a hero.
Put it down.
No piece of art is worth a human life.
So that's the movie Trance, which you're currently starring in. But at this very moment, you're actually playing Macbeth on the London stage. And congratulations, you were just nominated for an Olivier Award, right? For Best Actor, which is basically like the Tonys here in the US.
Yeah, the Olivier Awards. We also got nominated for Best Revival. Go team! We are over the moon. We are so proud of what we've done.
I've seen the pictures of you covered in dirt and blood, mm-hmm. looking very dark and brooding, playing the character. Is that hard to do, night after night after night?
When I kick a door in and I run onto stage, it's easy from that moment. But like right now, I'm sitting here going, how am I going to do this tonight? I feel like that quite a lot, but I probably find it more difficult doing this Macbeth than any of the action movies I've ever done. I've never been injured on an action movie. I have been injured playing this guy so much more than any action movie I've been on. But that's kind of the joy of it. We've got a really brave, bold, violent, in-your-face, scary production, and and it's the kind of Macbeth I've always wanted to be in.
James, you grew up in Glasgow, Scotland. What was your upbringing like?
I was brought up by my grandparents, so people go, oh, what was that like? That must have been hard. And you go, no, it wasn't. It was just completely, actually, normal, because the new norm seems to be whatever you make of it, doesn't it? I grew up in a council estate called Drumchapel. I think you guys call them projects.
Oh, like public housing?
Yeah. And I lived there until I was about 19.
I think a lot of people would think that was maybe a little bit rough. At least in the United States we would.
Yeah, you know, it's not like, I'm not doing it down. I love Drumchapel and I go back all the time. But yeah, it's not posh, do you know what I mean? And there's certainly rough aspects to it.
I'm speaking with actor James McAvoy. His new film is called Trance. You were raised Catholic as a child.
Yeah.
And I read that you once wanted to become a priest, which is funny because when I was in third grade, I wanted to become a nun. What changed your mind?
We could have got together and sort of not kissed and not touched each other for ages. It would have been amazing. Yeah, around about the age of 15 or so, I did consider it. And specifically, not just any old priest, I considered being a missionary, because I thought the whole kind of romantic idea of going off to far-flung regions and helping people and trying to do good and all that seemed not only a good thing to do and a romantic thing to do, but quite an adventurous thing to do. So I thought about that, but then I did start getting more luck with girls at about the same time, and that sort of put the kibosh on wedding my soul to God.
So girls and adventure.
Girls and adventure. And then acting kind of came along at that moment as well, which was weird. So I am so, so thankful, especially since I turned my back on God. He has not punished me. Thank you very much.
How do your grandparents feel about it?
They're proud as punch. They're beside themselves at times. And I love that. I really do love that, because I do remember they were amazing when I was growing up. They would, you know, support me in anything I would do. They wouldn't perhaps do it with the conviction and enthusiasm that would make me believe that I thought they thought I had any talent or that I deserved my place in the world as an actor. You know, they never told me you can be whatever you want to be, because I think they felt, and I feel like that's a lie. Nobody can be whatever they want to be. No kid can do whatever they want to do. It's a total lie. But they have the right to try and do whatever they want to do. That's their right to aim to do whatever they want to do. And you know what? Life might kick you in the face. Life might not let you do what you want to do. But they always taught me that, you know, go for it. Yeah, if you want to do that, go for it, son. You've got to do it. And that was really actually empowering, because from a very early age, I knew that, you know, life was risky, but you've got to take those risks.
You've been so successful at it. Is it everything you thought it was going to be?
I didn't know what I thought it was going to be. Honest to God, I did a movie and a couple of little TV shows when I was 16. Didn't do anything again. Got into drama school. Then I started working pretty much immediately after drama school. I wasn't really aware of what was going on, and I still hadn't really decided that I was an actor. I hadn't sort of said to myself, right, this is the rest of my life, because you can't, because there's still a big, massive part of me saying, what if the work dries up tomorrow? Then I'm not an actor anymore, you know? So it wasn't really until probably making Last King of Scotland in Uganda, going to one of those exotic places, going to one of those incredible other places and really getting in, that was probably the moment where I thought, oh my God, I'm actually doing this. I'm actually doing what it is that I was keen to do when I was 15 or 16. I'm having the life that I kind of hoped I might have one time, you know? I do feel like I have a place here, and at the least, I deserve it as much as anybody else, hopefully.
That's actor James McAvoy. His new film, Trance, opens in theaters next week. And if you happen to be in London, you can see him as Macbeth through April 27th at Trafalgar Studios. James, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a total pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan, and it's time now for music.
I just want to be closer. All right. Just a little closer. That's fine. Why can't I be?
This catchy little number is called Closer, and it's the title track from the new album by the vocal group Chic Gamin. And what you're hearing is just four voices and a drum set. That's it. Consider it minimalist Motown. Chic Gamin is from Winnipeg, Canada, and singer Andrina Turan joins us now from the CBC studios up there. Welcome.
Hello.
For those of us having trouble remembering some of our high school French, what does chic gamin mean?
Well, chic as in stylish, so chic. And gamin is means mischievous young thing.
In the moonlight, and the sun still sets, but don't forget your heart here. Go on, forget.
Tell me how your band got together, because it seems like kind of an unusual configuration for a group.
Yeah, it is, I guess, but we just have such a love of singing together and harmonies, and so our natural draw was to work together and to see if this configuration could work. And so we have four singers, myself, Andrina, Ariane Jean, Alexa Dirks, and Annick Brémont, all four of us from Winnipeg, Manitoba. And then the drummer Sacha Daoud is from Montreal, Quebec.
Do you ever miss having those huge, soaring horn sections that you hear in Motown music?
Well, we just try to create them with the voices. We enjoy singing those parts. I mean, it's nice to have a full band behind you, but, you know, as the band is growing, we're adding so much more instrumentation. We now have a Moog keyboard that we use for bass lines and a lot more guitar.
I think I actually hear a whistler on one of these songs.
Yeah.
The song "Don't Think That I Can Stay," and a very good whistler.
Alexa Dirks. She's a great whistler. She grew up in Winnipeg as well, in a different neighborhood, and I remember we heard her sing, and we were just like, holy smokes, who is this? We need to see if she would be interested in singing with us and starting a band. And Sasha is from Montreal, Quebec, which is a 27-hour drive away. And we asked him to be our drummer. So from the get-go, it was just like everybody took a chance on this, and everybody just said, okay, we're going to do this, but we don't really know what we're doing.
I'm speaking with Andrina Turan of the Canadian band Chic Gamin. Their first record in the U.S. is called Closer. I understand you got quite a compliment from American soul royalty. Let's just play a clip of her music first before I ask you about it. That's Mavis Staples. How did she discover your music? What did she say about you?
Well, we played at the Strawberry Music Festival in Northern California probably 4 years ago, and she was headlining the stage that we were playing on that night, so she was performing right after us. And I've been, like, such a long time Mavis Staples fan. We all have. So after the show, we met backstage afterwards, and she was telling us, she's like, oh, you guys were the girls singing. She's like, you reminded me of my sisters and I singing when we were kids. And it was really, really awesome. And it happened to be that day, my 27th birthday. And I was like, Mavis, that was an amazing show. There's one song, though, that you didn't sing that is my favorite one. And she's like, which one is that, baby? So I told her it was Let's Do It Again from this soundtrack of a movie that she did with Curtis Mayfield. So we just sang it. She sang it with me. We sang it, almost all of it, backstage.
Let's do it in the morning. Sweet breeze in the summertime.
And it was the greatest birthday present of all time.
All laid up next to mine.
Let me ask you about another song, Paper Moon, on the album. This feels like we're going even earlier than Motown. It feels like we're in the 1950s here.
Paper Moon, why do you shine so softly bright? Swallowing the rays of light and holding them over.
Tell me about this song.
When we started the band, everybody brought many songs and we started working on arrangements, and this one is sweet because actually we were at my parents have a cabin in northern Manitoba, and we went outside at night for a break and we actually arranged this one around a campfire under the moon. It was really, really beautiful moment.
So as the day grows cold and dark, your eyes fragile and echo to all the lovers who held up to you. Paper moon, cut out of my heart.
So what's going on here vocally? Who's doing what?
Okay, so Alexa is doing the bass part. Doom, doom, doo, doom. And then I'm harmonizing that part with her. And Ariane is singing sometimes with us and then sometimes doing the harmony on Anik, who is singing the lead.
And holding them over the night. Oh.
Some of your songs are in French.
Ben, Ben, d'où viens-tu? Moi qui croyais t'avoir perdu.
Is it difficult to deliver soul music in French rather than in English?
I don't think it's difficult. I think that when you're writing in different languages, there's some languages that are better to say certain things, you know?
Like what?
Well, you know, it's like the song that we have on our U.S. release, Tristesse Suspendue, is a super beautiful kind of poetic, like, lament, sort of, that for Ariane, when she wrote it, just came out in French.
Espérant ne plus te revoir, j'ai rempli mes sacs, vidé mon tiroir, et j'ai changé de page.
And what is it saying in French? What is that about?
So it's about a sadness, like a sadness that hangs over like a cloud, and when you move, it just follows you around, and you just can't sort of seem to get from under it.
So it sounds more French in that light than English.
Yeah, I guess maybe just the way, like the approach of the way you want to sing it, the like language fits it better. But you know, we're also into the idea of translating some of our songs so that we can do some of the songs in both the French and the English markets.
Oh, does that work? Is that hard?
It works. I mean, we do it to pop songs all the time, so why can't we do it to our own, you know? Like, we'll think of a pop song like, it's getting hot in here, and we'll say like, il fait chaud ici dedans, and change the words to French.
Days and days in the dark waiting for the light that used to be in my heart. Now I'm all out of feelings, so much for happy endings.
That's Andrina Turin of the band Chic Amin. Their latest album is called Closer, and you can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Andrina, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Laura.
There's a hole in my heart, and I don't need your love to fill it up. You tried to make me stay. I want to get away. I want to get away. I want to get away. I gotta get to the bottom of this. Oh, oh, oh. I gotta get to the bottom of this. I gotta get to the bottom of this. I gotta get to the bottom.
Folks, that That's it for our podcast this week. The people who put this show together, Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. The technical director is Rob Berman. Mathani Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Laura Sullivan. Don't worry, we'll be back next week with more of the best stories from All Things Considered on the weekend. And you can catch us Saturdays and Sundays on your local public radio station, or meet us right back here on the podcast. Until then, take care.